Well, good morning. Okay, I'm on. Hey, imagine if we could just take off our pretty much white, pretty much middle class, pretty much Protestant glasses off, our New Zealand glasses that we've grown up with, our cultural glasses. I heard a South African accent. Take off our South African cultural glasses. Perhaps take off our Māori or our Pacifica glasses just for a second, actually just for 20 minutes. Take off our perhaps our Malaysian or our Singaporean cultural glasses for a short time. And think about that scripture that was just read. Because we hear scripture all the time and, you know, we're reading it all the time, etc., etc. But did you really hear that scripture that was read? So, the king of Israel approached Elisha because he knew Elisha was dying. He knew he was near the end of his days. He approached him. And they understood metaphor in those days. He understands about holding the arrow, you know, holding the bow out towards the east, and Elisha's hands is on the bow. He understands the metaphor. He knows what that's about. And then he has approached Elisha, and Elisha says to him, "Grab these arrows now and hit the ground with them." And it's a story of squandered potential, amongst other things perhaps, but squandered potential. They could have done so much, but the leader of the nation squandered that potential. And I reckon that many of us, and personally I think the New Zealand church, squanders their potential. Partly that's because we've been a little bit beaten down because the media's been on our back for 25 years. And I think that a lot of this, you don't have to believe me, but my feeling is that New Zealand Christians feel a little bit demoralized. But I think that we are a church in New Zealand that has squandered our potential somewhat. I think I squander my potential. So I've been doing ministry or been involved, if you want to call it that, in full-time ministry for about 34 years. And 28 of those years have been where my wife and I, we set up Empower Asia back in the day. And then we moved to Thailand and then we moved on to other places. I'll just switch this on. Okay, and we moved to Thailand and then we set up in Myanmar and in Nepal and West Bengal. In India, and then in Bhutan, Cambodia. But this is what I reckon. And this comes from 28 years running this mission. This is my theory. You can believe it or you cannot accept it. It's up to you. This is my thought. I reckon this. The world is our oyster. I'm not trying to be motivational and G you up. I mean it seriously. I really mean it. The world is our oyster. When we, when I first went to West Bengal in India, that's one of the first places that I saw. They are bags full of sand, and it's on the Ganges River. And those women sitting there are sex workers. And those little huts is where they take their clients. And basically, it's kind of like an open-air brothel in West Bengal, in a place called Faraka. And you look at Faraka and you think, well, what? It's terrible, but what am I going to do about it? And this is the truth. There's no bragging in this. It wasn't even hard. We just decided that if there were women there who were aged 20 or 30 or 40 who were working in those brothels in Faraka, which is in the region of Murshidabad in West Bengal. Murshidabad is one of the two biggest sources of sex trafficking in India. So Murshidabad is either number one or number two for India. And I just talked to my mate, Ong Mung, who's a Burmese guy who was with me. And I said to Ong, why don't we do something about it? And it was easy. It wasn't even hard. We decided that we'd begin to take in girls who were aged probably about 14, who showed all the right parameters of ending up being sex trafficked. And so now we have a home, and it's run by local people, an Indian man, who is nothing like an Indian, actually. He comes from very, very close by to Myanmar. He's from Mizoram, if you know Mizoram, one of the most Christian areas in the world. It borders onto Myanmar. And his wife is Chin Burmese. And they lived together in Myanmar for quite some time, and then they shifted to Kolkata. So they've started up this work that prevents girls from being sex trafficked. Now, we can't solve all the problems, but you know, you eat an elephant one bite at a time. And this is the truth, I'm not exaggerating. It wasn't even that hard to set up. And so after all of those years, I feel even stronger now that the world is our oyster, and we can make, and I'm not talking this up, I think that we can make a genuine, positive, quality impact on the world. But I reckon probably, deep down, most of us don't believe that. But we can. So I don't know whether that makes you feel a bit uncomfortable that I say that. Hopefully it does. There'd be nothing worse than you just sitting there going, oh yeah, wonder what's for lunch. There'll be nothing worse than that. So we've been doing this for a long time, and it's difficult, but it's not as hard as you would think. And partly it's not so hard as you would think because nowadays to fly anywhere is quite cheap. Hey, you can fly Air Asia to Bali for $260 return. Also, New Zealand is a relatively very wealthy country. So we have income, we have money that we can spend on mission. And also with the advent of quality internet, I can Facebook message my house parents. It's a piece of cake, mate. I can talk to them anytime I like. It's not hard. Every now and then it cuts out, but whatever. It's not a big deal. It's not even that hard. So I guess I'm kind of laboring the point here a wee bit, but you know what I'm saying. So when we shifted to Asia all those years ago, about 28 years ago, Carly and I shifted there, we were just like any other little missionary couple, except we didn't have a mission organization to go to because the one we applied to didn't want us. So we went anyway, and we hadn't done Bible college because I just couldn't stand the thought. If you're at Bible college, it's wonderful. You keep staying there, but I just couldn't stand the thought of another 3 or 4 years of tertiary education. I just couldn't stand the thought of it. So we got involved in mission in Tokoroa, and a lot of cross-cultural mission in Tokoroa. And then after that, we shifted to Thailand. And I wouldn't necessarily advocate for other people to do it the way we did. I wouldn't necessarily support that, but it worked for us. And then after a short period of time in Thailand, where we continuously failed, of course, because that's what you do for the first 5 years, we realized that actually, let's make this assumption. Let's assume that if we expand our work, we don't need missionaries. Let's make that assumption. Now that goes against the, and there's some wonderful OMF, SIM, yeah, they're awesome organizations. I'm not knocking them, and I'm not knocking people who are missionaries or people who want to become missionaries. I'm not knocking that, but we made an assumption that we didn't need missionaries, that we would do whatever it took to use local indigenous people to run the mission. And by and large, it's worked really well. Hasn't always worked, but by and large, very well. And it means that we can save ourselves many tens of thousands of dollars a year because we don't have to support missionary families and their kids on the mission field, etc., because we can just use local people. And so because we've made that assumption, we've been able to go into areas where missionaries can't go. And so I've probably showed you, I won't do it now, but I've probably showed you our Wa boys, who are the Wa are the biggest producers of methamphetamine in the world. We're able to go into the Wa lands that are remote and you can't get in there. But we can just use our little Burmese people to get in there and to find kids. So we've got a Wa boys home of about 25, 30 guys. And so sometimes, for some of the kids, I'm the first white person that they've ever seen. And I say to them, mate, they're not all as good looking as me, but you can hold me up as an example if you like. And some of the work we do is the world only work. There's nothing else there. There's nothing else there. When we first set up in Myanmar, and that was about 20 years ago, I guess now. I can't recall, 20-something years ago. Myanmar was put in the too hard basket by a lot of mission organizations. I don't mean they admitted that it was too hard, but in terms of presentation and what you saw in terms of evidence, it had been put in the too hard basket. And it was a very stroppy, very militant army-run government at that time. And you know what their army's like because you're seeing what they're doing now with Rohingya Muslims. Well, that's what they've been doing with Karen refugees, a Karen people for the last 30 years, 40 years. So that's what they've been like. So when we went there was almost no mission organizations at all. And part of the reason for that is that mission organizations, right or wrong, pretty much assume that if you're going to have a mission organization, you send missionaries. And you see, we didn't make that assumption. We assumed that we could do it without missionaries. And so you fellows have been supporting our Yangon boys home, but we have a Yangon girls home and a Sitwe boys and girls home and a Klemyo boys and girls home and a Wat one and one in Tongji and one in Changtong as well. And they've all been set up by local people. And it might sound grandiose and, well, eight homes, but if we wanted to, we could have 14. It's just that we're choosing to develop the eight homes that we have now. So it wasn't really as hard as you might think. And oh, the world is your oyster, and you can make a significant, measurable difference in that society where you choose to do mission. And one of the things I want to say to you today is please continue to partner in with us. Please. Listen, keep going with us. And it may be that you have a desire to go into some country and do some sort of work. It's possible. It's not as hard as you might think it is. And it certainly isn't rocket science. Carly and I were a young couple full of passion for mission, but not wonderfully educated. There was nothing particularly special about us. And as far as I know, Tokoro is not the center, the cultural center and academic center for New Zealand. So maybe you have never thought or considered that you could do or be actively involved in world mission. Well, I'm here today to tell you that you can be. And maybe you've never thought of it. Well, I hope you're thinking about it now. The other thing I'd say is that a lot of people are risk-averse. They're a little bit scared to, what happens if I fail? Or what happens if it doesn't work out? And you can have a whole myriad of negative feelings about world mission. Well, the bottom line is, I don't really think God respects risk aversion. Those in the Bible who we read about, they were people who would take risks. And they'd step out, and sometimes they got killed for it. Sometimes they were incredibly blessed in the things that God led them into. But risk aversion is not an excuse. Perhaps you're scared, and it would be understandable if you were scared. I quite understand why you might be scared. And the Apostle Paul writes out of 2 Corinthians, "We do not want you to be uninformed, brothers and sisters, about the troubles that we experienced in the province of Asia. We were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure, so that we despaired of life itself. Indeed, we felt we had received the sentence of death. But this happened that we might not rely on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead." Now let's keep our cultural glasses off. Let's not put them back on our head again. The Bible is all about trusting God, taking risks. It is, eh? You can't deny that. It is. And if mum and dad, if you want to develop your young people, your kids, your grandkids, to become really good Christian young people in the future, help them to take risks. Endorse them taking risks. Don't helicopter, you know, look after and control every little thing in their lives. Encourage them to take risks for the gospel. Encourage it. Encourage them to step out and to do things that you might not necessarily want to do. But if they're young people, if young people discover that, oh, God actually saved my butt, and I came up with the money that I was trying to raise, or that thing that I was trying to achieve, it actually happened, then your faith that you're trying to pass on to them, it becomes their faith. And when it becomes their faith, that's when they'll keep going. The good thing for me was I wasn't brought up in a Christian home. And in some ways it's easier for me to be a little bit more radical than people who are brought up in a Christian home, because I didn't inherit anybody else's faith. So, you know, like, you got Easter camp coming up. I became a Christian at a camp. The Brethren's, they got me a long time ago. So when we set up in, I mean, isn't she gorgeous? Isn't she just gorgeous? Her and her friends are the sort of girls that get sex trafficked. Imagine that. Imagine if that wee girl there got sex trafficked into either the top of Thailand in Chiang Mai or Chiang Rai, or over into, probably not Laos, but over into China. So she's a girl that lives in the Golden Triangle, which, you know, is Thai, Laos, and Myanmar. That's where she comes from. When we started our home in Changdong, again, it was just my Burmese mates. So I said to them, there's a whole lot of people who are trafficked in from the Golden Triangle that end up in Thailand, etc. And it's a massive area for opium, heroin, and methamphetamine. Why don't we start a girls' home there so we can begin to slowly and tinily, I mean, it's just tiny what we do, begin to arrest that problem of sex trafficking. Well, 3 months later, the home was running. It wasn't that hard. And so also another example is these boys here are from Bhutan. And Bhutan is a very small little Himalayan kingdom, a population of about 800,000. And it is staunchly Buddhist. And it sits between China and India. And we wanted, because our work, what we do is we get a hold of kids who we're going to try and evangelize, disciple, so that they will go back to their own people as Christian leaders, to be salt and light within their own country. So that's our aim. Primarily, we get a hold of impoverished, very at risk, normally non-Christian kids. Now the situation in Bhutan is that boys and girls get to about the age of 17, they finished high school, but Bhutan has a policy of trying to select Buddhist kids to go on in the education system instead of Christian kids. Now that can happen a bit in Malaysia too. That's why we have so many Chinese Malaysians who go to uni in New Zealand, because it's hard for them to get into uni in Malaysia. So what we did, well, we couldn't set up a boys' home in Bhutan because it would get shut down like that fast. So we just brought them over the border to India, into Kalimpong, which is near Darjeeling. And the boys stay at our hostel in Darjeeling. And so we can take about 17 or 18 or maybe 20 guys into that hostel. So at the moment we've got six, and the boys have just gone back to Bhutan now, and they are promoting the work amongst their mates in Bhutan as we speak, and we hope to have 12 shortly. Does this sound very hard? It's not very hard. It's a matter of communicating and talking to people and going visiting and sharing the vision and fundraising, and it's not that hard. And so these guys go back to Bhutan, and we expect them to be, well, I actually expect some of these guys to be the church leaders of Bhutan in the future. That would be our expectation. I'm sure I must have read this verse to you before. I'm going to read it again. 1 John chapter 3, verse 16 to 18. This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. If anyone has material possessions and sees a brother or sister in need but has no pity on them, how can the love of God be in them? In that person, dear children, let us not love with words or speech, but with actions and in truth. Now if that little girl was your niece or your granddaughter or your daughter or whatever, you wouldn't let her become a child prostitute. I know you wouldn't, obviously. I mean, it goes without saying, you're not going to endorse that. But the scripture that I just read to you is talking about how, even though she lives far away from you, she's 13 hours flight away from you, and then she's about another 6 hours in a van, she is still your daughter, and those boys, they're still your sons, and they're still your grandsons, and they're still your granddaughters, and they're your mothers, and they're your aunties, and they're your nieces. We wouldn't let our children end up as sex workers, so we have a responsibility as Christian people to not allow kids like her to end up as sex workers. And when you are caught by the New Zealand media protecting and enabling and mentoring and empowering young women like this, then they'll begin to love you. Then they'll begin to respect our Christianity. So I want to say that looking after the poor and looking after the impoverished and the orphaned and the widow, etc., especially in those sort of countries, it's not an optional extra. It's not just something you do. It's not just Josh's thing because Josh is into that sort of stuff. It's our responsibility. It's our thing. It's not an optional extra for Christians. We're meant to be all involved in that sort of thing. And so even this, there's some of my little white boys, rough as guts. Those boys here, I was with them just last week. So the boy on the left, we got him when he was about 14. Now he's a high school principal. And he thinks a lot about education. He's very serious about education. So I've just sent him a whole lot of links about how Finland is now doing their education, because they don't have maths one period and then Finnish one period and then English the next. They don't do that anymore. They've changed the way they do it. The one in the middle writes apps. He works for a New Zealand company in Kathmandu, and he produces apps. He's doing an app that's a little bit like Tinder. You know Tinder, right? You shouldn't know Tinder. You don't know. He's doing it for events in Florida, believe it or not. But it's kind of a little bit based on the Tinder thing. You just swipe left and right and to look at events and things that are going on in Florida. The boy on the right, he's on our board now. He came to us when he was about 14. He's 24 now. And he is an untouchable. His house, he told me just the other day, we've videoed interviews. His house is literally 2 meters by 4 meters in size, about the size of a good old bathroom in New Zealand. And it's made of mud, and it has hay for a roof. His mum ran away or left them when she was very young. Dad's extremely sick. And so we got a hold of him when he was 14, and he came to live with us and went through the school system and got a degree in biotech. And then he switched over and got a master's degree in water management. And they're training him up to be one of the main water managers for the country. And Nepal has massive water management issues, really big. And so he's expecting soon that he's actually going to do a PhD in water management. And if our work wasn't there 10 years ago, well, he probably never would have finished high school. And listen, I'm not bragging. I'm not showing off. I'm just saying that that's the result of having that work. We're developing young people like this. And they're really good quality people. And so I say it again. Take off your glasses. Take off your thought, your expectations or your cultural thoughts on what things would be like overseas. Take that all off for a minute, and I want to say to you that we can, together, or you do your own thing, you can make measurable, positive changes within this world. Think of some of the worst countries in the world. What's the worst country in the world right now? Oh, North Korea. The Koreans will get it. The South Koreans will get a hold of North Korea. We don't have to worry about that one. Syria. I heard Syria. I heard Iraq. Somalia. Yeah, Australia, ball tamperers, they've been caught cheating. Why can't we go into Syria? Not right now, but why can't we go into Syria? The reason why we can't go into Syria, the main reason is because we think we can't. I tell you, that's true. We think we can't, and therefore, because we think we can't, it won't happen. And there's all sorts of obstacles to going in there right now, obviously. But 2-3 years from now, it's entirely possible that we could partner up with some wonderful Syrian pastors to start work for young people to develop Syrian Christian leadership. It is entirely possible. Iraq likewise. In a second I'm going to finish, but you know that story, and again, I'm sure I've read this verse to you before. So just quickly, you know the story where the Tower of Babel and all these people have got together and they've decided that they're going to build this tower, and God comes down and he sees it and he's none too happy. The tower is probably going to be an astrological site above the clouds so they can look at the stars the whole time. And this is not a Christian or Jewish Hebrew endeavor at the time. This is out of Genesis 11. I'm just going to read a couple of verses. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower the people were building. The Lord said, if as one people speaking the same language they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. So he mixes up their languages so they develop their own subcultures and they splinter. The power of unity, the power of partnership. And we're not talking about a Christian endeavor here, but the ability for mankind to carry out the impossible. Whether for good reason or bad, mankind has the ability to do it. How much more can we do as Christian people when God empowers us? And like I said, today we have, you know, air travel is cheap, Facebook Messenger or Skype or whatever. It's not so difficult for us now to set up works right around the world. My office is just my lounge in Invercargill. Now, a lot of people probably think, oh, they've got an office somewhere downtown. Forget about that. We don't need that. My office could be, honestly, my office could be the size of my boy Kulman. It could be half the size of his house. It could be just 4 square meters. And you can run that work all from there. I live in New Zealand now. I don't even have to live overseas if I don't want to, because our people overseas are running everything. So now I've got to tell you some I want to challenge you with this. We look after about 275 teenagers spread over six countries. We're on the cusp of taking about another 50 in, which would mean we'd be increasing by about 15% maybe over the next couple of months. So you know where I'm going with this. And most of those kids will actually, they'll be Myanmar kids, most of them will be. And so obviously we are on the prowl trying to find support. And I expect that if we take on 50 kids, it'll probably cost about $3,500 per month extra that we need. The truth is right now we can afford that because we can just take money out of reserves. But in the long run, you can't do that. You've got to raise the support. And so we're trying to raise $3,000 per month extra. Just to give you an idea, a kilogram of rice over there costs about a dollar. So one of those big massive sacks, brown sacks of rice, is about $100. And if you wanted to buy a brown sack of rice once a month, 20 kids, it would probably take them at least 3 weeks to knock it off. At least 3 weeks. But also with support, obviously we want to give our kids nutritious food, veggies, meat, which a lot of them have never had, education costs, etc., etc. So the Yangon Boys Home, we're going to take on about another six boys. The Girls Home, just next door, we're going to take on about another six girls. So if you got all excited about sponsoring another six boys to go into that Yangon Boys Home, it would cost about roughly $350 a month, something like that. So if that spins your wheels, just let me know. Hey, can I do the same thing as last time? If you want to get any of our propaganda, I'll have it out there. Just write your details on there. Write it neatly. And listen, we're not always bothering you with information all the time, but if you write your name down, I'll get back to you, and what I'll ask you is there a particular project that spins your wheels? Because we have certain projects where expenditure certainly exceeds income, and so we're trying to up the income. So there's projects there that not only do you get the normal newsletter, which doesn't go out that often, but we can send you info pertinent to your particular project. Okay, I'm going to finish now, and I'm going to say it one more time. The world is your oyster. You can make clear, measurable, monitored, honest, no hype marks for positive on your world. I guarantee it, you can. There's ways and means of doing it, and I thank you that you're helping us to do that in Yangon. And I encourage you to get involved in your world, not just in New Zealand, but overseas in your world. Okay, God bless.